Your veterinarian will examine your dog's teeth closely and take x-rays of each tooth. Any diseased teeth will be extracted, and your dog will likely be treated with antibiotics. In many dogs, taking care of dental disease alleviates recurrent sneezing. Next is nasal problems. A nasal foreign body, in contrast, in other words, some foreign object in the dog's nose, is usually addressed surgically. Your veterinarian will sedate your dog and then attempt to flush or extract any foreign material from the nose. Removal of a nasal foreign body is curative. No further treatment is usually needed once the object has been removed from the nose. Nasal tumors are relatively uncommon, but they do occur. Treatment may require a combination of therapies. Depending on the tumor and its location, your vet may recommend surgery, radiation therapy, and/or chemotherapy. And finally, sneezing can also be due to excitement. While some sneezing has a medical cause, this isn't always the case. Believe it or not, dogs also use sneezing to communicate with other dogs and their human companions. Sneezing is often associated with excitement, indicating a desire to play or interact. In fact, many dogs use sneezing to get their owner's attention. Sneezing may also be used as a sign of submission in some contexts, or it may be used as a way to de-escalate rough play. And not to worry, because behavioral sneezing usually doesn't indicate any sort of an underlying medical problem. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Finally, we have a piece by Megan Milstead, and it's titled, Four Things You Should Never Do to Your Cat, According to an Expert. As cat lovers, we'd go to the ends of the earth for our furry friends. Despite what many people think, cats can be very affectionate pets and give you endless hours of joy. And there's nothing we wouldn't do to keep them happy, whether that's buying them the best cat bed, making time to play with them using the best cat toys, or learning how to keep a cat warm outside during cold weather. However, there are some misconceptions about cat communication and a few things you might need to be aware of. And although you might mean well and see other people doing these things, your cat will probably misinterpret them. Amanda Campion, a clinical animal behaviorist, shared four things she would never do to her cat and why. And here they are. First, using water guns. Using any form of water as a punishment, whether it's a gun, water pistol, spray bottle, is a big no-no for Amanda, and it's something she would never do. As everyone knows, most cats hate water, so it might seem like the best way to teach your furry friend a lesson. However, she explains cats do not respond to negative punishment, so it's best to give this one a miss. The next no-no is yelling at the cat. As humans, it's natural to want to scream and yell if something has really got us ticked off. Cats are playful creatures, so they're probably going to make a mess and cause some kind of chaos from time to time. Shouting might make you feel a little better, but it's not going to solve the problem in the future. Amanda explains that yelling will just make your cat scared of you and spoil the bond you've created, so it's really not worth it in the long run. Number 3, anthropomorphizing bad behavior. Amanda also says that she would never anthropomorphize her cat's behavior. By the way, that long word is just a fancy way of saying giving them human characteristics. Our cats might feel like part of the family, but it's important to remember that they are animals and will never do anything out of spite like a human might. That means we shouldn't be punishing them for bad behavior, like peeing outside the litter box, as it simply isn't true. And number 4, and this is important, ignoring their behavior. Never ignore your cat if they're acting strange or their behavior is a little off. It could be a sign that they're trying to communicate with you. Amanda recommends that if this is happening, you might want to look into it further and paying a visit to the vet just to make sure everything's okay. And that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the Pet Radar website, the USDA.gov website, the Cat Time website, and the PetMD website. I'm Mario Cahar. So long till next time.
You're listening to Chris Radio, Connecticut's talking newsstand. It's 8:30.
Chris Sports. Chris takes a look now at the sports sections of today's newspapers. The sports data. Sports stats you get only from the newspaper. Now, Chris Sports.
Hi, everyone. It is Friday, April 19th. Welcome to Chris Sports. And we're double-teaming the program today. I'm Scott. Bill Murphy will be along in a little bit, and he'll finish up the program. But we'll begin with the Hartford Current Sports page again for Friday, April 19th. This by Dom Amore, Marone's grandson brings legendary coach's passion. Mitchell Tainter was born to play soccer, born into Connecticut's royal family of the beautiful game. When you're Joe Marone's grandson, soccer is bound to latch onto your soul as it has latched onto his. My grandfather was at every single game of mine growing up, every single training, Tainter says. He was in the basement with me in February when it was snowing out, kicking the ball with me, trying to teach me all the things he knew. We were so close, we really bonded over soccer. I was one of nine of his grandchildren, and I was the only one who took on soccer and showed a liking for it. Marone coached soccer at UConn from 1969 to 96, winning the NCAA championship in 1981 with his sons Bill and Joe Jr., Tainter's uncles, on the team. His daughter, Melissa Marone Tainter, Mitchell's mom, played for the UConn women's team, an All-American who played in three Final Fours and is in the Connecticut Soccer Hall of Fame. She was a baller back in the day, and I was fortunate to benefit from that, Tainter says, and I still do. She has so much knowledge, and the learning never stops in this game. Mitchell Tainter, 29, in his seventh season as a professional, is leaving his own mark on the game. The captain of San Antonio FC, he's bringing the family crest back home to play Hartford Athletic in a USL championship match Saturday night at Trinity Health Stadium in Hartford. When I was 8 years old, I wanted to be a professional soccer player, Tainter says. It was my dream. My parents couldn't get me inside when the sun was going down. I was always playing. I wanted to win. I had the drive. I was competitive. I was a high-energy kid. I come from a high-energy family. The patriarch of the soccer clan, Joe Marone, was known for his rigor, passion, sometimes showing itself on the sidelines in the form of clipboards shattered over his knee. But the martinet had a gentler side as the grandfather to a young player, at least to some degree. No tattoos, no earrings, no hair below the ears, says Tainter, who, by recent photos, honors the last two of his grandfather's dictums. Mitchell's parents put down some artificial turf from the local hardware store in the basement, and that's where Tainter and his grandfather worked for hours on end, on his skills. For him, the biggest thing was your effort and your attitude, Tainter says. If your effort and your attitude was right, you're working hard, you're going to make progress. We didn't have much film. He was trying to teach me about body position, about my touch, technique, passing technique, dribbling, building fundamentals. He always said, you're never too good for the basics, and that always stuck with me. Tainter played at nearby E.O. Smith High in Storrs, where his mother played 4 years and never lost a game, and then played in the New England Revolution's Developmental Academy, his grandfather, by then in his 70s, often driving him from Storrs to Massachusetts for the practices and games. Then he went to Rutgers, where he played 4 years, including a game at UConn, in the Joseph J. Marone Stadium in 2013, the last time he played in Connecticut. Drafted by Toronto in the Major League Soccer Super Draft in the third round in 2016, Tainter has played for various pro teams. He joined San Antonio in 2021. The next season, he was a first-team All-Leaguer and the USL's Defensive Player of the Year for San Antonio's 2022 championship team. Very good player, a lot of respect for what he's accomplished in the league, athletic coach Brendan Burke says. Hard-nosed defender, decent with the ball. He's done a really good job at San Antonio. He kind of fits their brand. He flings himself around. They're an ultra-physical team, and he steps up and fights for those guys every night. Tainter was a senior at Rutgers in 2015 when his grandfather, 79, died from pancreatic cancer. I remember this exactly, he says. We were playing a game at Monmouth, and it was halftime. My grandfather wasn't doing well. I just felt this pit in my stomach, felt real warm. I was thinking of him. I texted my mom at halftime. I didn't see the response. I called after the game, and she told me he had passed away about an hour before. It was this weird feeling I had, this undeniable connection we had. We were just always connected, two peas in a pod, and I miss him a lot. Tainter, 6 feet one, is known as a combative player, and in San Antonio's culture, Coach Alan Marcina gives him the freedom to play his type of game and let his passion show. That's what he hopes fans take away from watching him play in Connecticut, the soccer spirit that came from his granddad. I hope they see someone from a small town, a small state, often overlooked, Tainter says, and someone who has worked very hard to get where they are, someone who's been committed to something his entire life, had a dream. Plenty of people said no, didn't believe in it. Everything can come true if you want it to. Effort and attitude, play with passion. It's a player's game. We have to make decisions on the field, and that's why we play sports, to feel something you don't feel anywhere else. Tainter is healthy, feels like he is in his prime of his career, and hopes to play several more seasons in a league that had grown since he began. Does one even need to ask what he'd like to do when he's done playing? I feel like I have a lot to give in the game, Tainter says, but long term, I want to coach in college. My grandfather did it for 30, 40 years, and I want to be the coach the kids have that makes an impact on who they are as people. The next generation, I want to develop them into winners, and I still want to compete and win championships in whatever capacity that is. It's a cool thing to do. It's something that's close to my heart. Here's a guess. Coach Tainter may be a little more flexible when it comes to tattoos, earrings, and facial hair, but if he's holding a clipboard, keep your distance. All right, we'll go to a Patriots article now. This from Andrew Callahan, the Boston Herald. Wolf keeps his options open for the NFL draft. If you believe the Patriots will trade the number 3 overall pick in next week's draft, here's all the proof you need, courtesy of de facto GM Elliot Wolf. We're open for business in the first round and in every round, Wolf said Thursday during his pre-draft press conference. We have some holes we feel like we need to fill in the draft. We're drafting to develop the team. The more picks we have, the better. But if you think the Patriots will draft a quarterback at number 3, here's your two-piece smoking gun. Yeah, Wolf said, answering whether he expects a quarterback worthy of the 3rd overall pick to be available. Does he feel Drake May, J.J. McCarthy, or Jaden Daniels could lead the team, and the Patriots wouldn't be settling if they drafted any one of them? Yeah, I think that's fair, Wolf replied. And if you contend the Patriots are still, somehow, undecided on what to do with their top pick, well, see above. Mixed messages galore. In speaking to reporters on Thursday, Wolf wisely muddied the waters, understanding his target audience was not the assembled media before him, but his competitors and colleagues, the 31 other front NFL offices who will study the tape of his press conference for clues about his draft intentions. and the players, coaches, and scouts inside his own building still learning about their new leader. Because while Wolf established himself as a sharp evaluator years ago, serving as the de facto GM is brand new. Everyone is watching to see how Wolf fills these shoes, how he walks, talks, and whether he can walk the walk and talk the talk. Every word counts, every minute matters. To that end, Wolf pulled assistant coaches from their pre-scheduled vacations in late March to cover pro days because of how vital this draft is to the franchise's future, to his future, to their future. So, before taking a single question Thursday, the 42-year-old executive thanked them for their service. I also wanted to thank the Crafts for their support, thank Coach Jared Mayo and his staff throughout this draft process. It's been great, Wolf said, collaborating with them and working with them, you know, private workouts and Zoom calls and getting their reports in on those things. I wanted to thank the scouts for their tireless effort to get this draft class right over the last, call it, 3 years. Being away from their families, working on the road, digging out information, being passionate about what they do, and also representing the Patriots in a professional manner. A small but wise gesture, in February, Wolf explained the Packer way, something now being installed in New England by citing, quote, honesty, respect, and treating people the right way. This was Wolf, 6 weeks later, walking the walk. Because while a scout is measured by the written word of his reports, a GM must be accountable to his every syllable, public and private. He is responsible for advancing the team's interests and protecting them, particularly against outsiders and critics. On Thursday, Wolf risked bewildering his fan base to stand by his players, specifically the most maligned on the Patriots roster, the wide receivers and offensive linemen. I do, yes, Wolf said when asked if he feels the two groups are underrated. I mean, we have NFL receivers, we have NFL tight ends, and we have NFL running backs, we have NFL offensive linemen. We feel good about where we are. As for the draft, Wolf admitted Patriots' top decision-makers are at the doorstep of consensus on how they feel about the best available quarterbacks, and if we are being honest with ourselves, the talent available in the Patriots' shoddy depth chart, Wolf is taking a quarterback at number 3 overall. For months, drafting May or Daniels has represented the simplest solution to the Patriots' thorniest problem. Wolf also does not subscribe to the notion the Patriots are not prepared to support a rookie, though he's heard your concerns. And before I turn it over to Bill, I'll just let you know, in case you haven't heard, the Red Sox fell to the Guardians 5-4 yesterday. All right, Bill, you're up.
Well, I'm going to read a story on the Knicks. How do you prepare for a relying league, reigning league most valuable player recently returned from knee surgery? You treat him like the MVP, then figure out the rest later. The Philadelphia 76ers won Wednesday night's 7-8 game over the Miami Heat and earned the right to face the number 2 Knicks in the first round of the playoffs, which means the Knicks have to prepare for one of the NBA's most dominant players, Joel Embiid, who won the MVP award last season and had his 2023-24 campaign derailed by a meniscus injury. Embiid underwent surgery in early February to repair the lateral meniscus in his left knee, then returned to play in 5 of Philadelphia's final 7 regular season games. He sat the second leg of a back-to-back and rested the Sixers' season finale against the San Antonio Spurs. And then he came up big for Philadelphia in a come-from-behind victory over the Heat on Wednesday with 23 points, 15 rebounds, 5 assists, and a pair of threes. Embiid did his damage while clearly limited by his knee, but with 2 more days for the Team USA-bound center to recover before Game 1 at Madison Square Garden on Saturday, the Knicks are treating the all-NBA big man like he's at full strength. Treating him as anything less would be a recipe for an early first-round playoff exit. it's the playoffs, so you're not dealing with the back-to-backs and that sort of thing, head coach Tom Thibodeau said after practice in Tarrytown on Thursday. So we're anticipating him to be who he is. NBA's final five regular season games paint a clear picture of a player who found his rhythm, ramping up for a playoff run. He scored 24 points in 29 minutes in his first game back from surgery on April 2nd, leading the Sixers to victory over the West's number one seeded Oklahoma City Thunder. He then scored 29 points in 33 minutes in a victory over the Heat 2 days later and finished the regular season with three straight games of 30 or more against the Memphis Grizzlies, Detroit Pistons, and Orlando Magic. MB had made at least two threes in four of those five games following his injury return. He shot 48% from deep post-surgery and shot 2 of 4 from downtown in Wednesday's play-in win over the Heat. The Sixers star finished the season averaging 34.7 points, 11 rebounds, 5.6 assists, 1.7 blocks, and 1.2 steals on 53% shooting from the field and a career-high 38.8% shooting from three-point range. His numbers over the final five regular season games are about in line with his season averages, give or take a rebound here or a bucket there. And before we go to the weather, I just want to tell you this playoff schedule. The Celtics will be playing either the Heat or the Bulls on Sunday at 1 p.m. On ABC. Then they'll have game two and Wednesday at the Celtics. And the rest of them, we'll just keep up with it as the series goes along. And then, of course, the New York-Philadelphia game, the Knicks and the 76ers, Saturday at 6 p.m. on ESPN. And then again in game two, 76ers at the Knicks, that'll be Monday, 7:30 p.m. TNT. And then games 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, if necessary, will be played then. When the Connecticut Sun take the court for the 2024 WNBA season, they'll do so in some new threads. The team had introduced its new Nike Rebel Edition uniform, which it says was designed in collaboration with Mohegan Tribe. The jersey features the word mark KEESUSK, that's K-E-E-S-U-S-K, on the front, which means sun in the Mohegan language. Kisos has been featured on the team's alternate uniform since 2021. This year's uniform is black with a purple and white along the neckline, which is modeled after a traditional wampum collar, according to the team. Wampum, a quahog or whelk shell found in the ocean and on tribal shorelines, has been used for centuries by tribal nations to show honor, connection, and relationships between nations. Outside of being gifted by itself, wampum is often used to make necklaces and belts. Also, the two diamond shapes represent the sun, as well as the Orlando Miracle, which the Mohegan Tribe purchased in 2003 and rebranded as the Connecticut Sun. Fans can find the jerseys on the Sun's official website. The season begins May 14th as Connecticut takes on number one overall pick Caitlin Clark in Indiana at Mohegan Sun Arena at 7:30 p.m. Now, we're going to go over to Huskies basketball. He was the first team all NCAA tournament, first team all East region, and first team all Big East. On Wednesday, Cam Spencer earned his first team honors for his work in the classroom as well. UConn men's basketball standout was named a first-team 2023-24 Academic All-American by the College Sports Communicators, that's CSC. The graduate guard became the fourth Husky to earn CSC Academic All-American honors in program history, joining UConn legends Wes Bellasugna from 1966 to 67 and Amika Okafor from 2002 to 2004, and Randy Levine, 1977-78. Earlier this week, the CSC announced UConn women's basketball star Paige Beckers had also been named a first-team academic All-American. Spencer is pursuing a certificate in nonprofit management at UConn and holds a 3.50 GPA, according to the school. He finished his undergraduate time with a 3.80 GPA. On the court this season, Spencer ranked second on the team in scoring, averaging 14.3 points per game. As expected, Alex Caraban will show his skills to NBA scouts and coaches before deciding where to play next season. Caraban, a sophomore forward, has been a starter on the Huskies' back-to-back national champions and has talked about going for a three-peat as a junior in 2024-25, but he has the option of entering the NBA draft, working out, and getting feedback from teams before deciding whether to enter the draft or return to UConn for another season. After many conversations, I am beyond excited to chase my NBA dream and enter the 2024 NBA draft while maintaining my college eligibility, Caraban said via social media. Caraban has until June 16th to decide whether to withdraw from draft consideration and return to school or go pro and forego his final years of eligibility. At 6 feet eight, Caraban has NBA size for the position and adds three-point shooting ability and a versatile skill set. In 78 games, he has averaged 11.3 points, 4.8 rebounds, 1.8 assists, shooting 48.7% from the floor, 38.9% on three-point attempts. The question to consider is where he would be picked. Teammates Donovan Clingan was already declared, and Stephon Castle, expected to announce his intentions this week, are both projected to go high in the first round, where millions would be guaranteed. If the feedback Caraban 21 gets indicates he would be drafted in the second round or at all, he could decide to return and play another season to boost his stock. And now we're going to go to the story about the next man in the middle. That's the headline here. It says, who is Terrace Reed Jr.? A look at the ex-Michigan big man who could fill a starting role. It's a sad reality for UConn men's basketball fans to think about, but next year the Huskies won't be led by Bristol native and 7-foot wunderkind Donovan Clingan in the middle. They'll have to move on from the big man who leaves stores and heads to the NBA with two championships in 2 years and a lifelong UConn legacy. Who will replace Clingan? In the hearts and minds of fans, it's not clear that anybody can. On the court, it may be even harder to replace him. On Wednesday, part of Dan Hurley's plan to gear up for a run at an unprecedented modern-era three-peat became clear as Michigan transfer Terrace Reed Jr. announced his commitment to UConn. At 6 feet 10, 265 pounds, he's an athletic, bruising, big, though not quite as imposing as the 7'2", 285-pound Clingan. Though Hurley may not be done portal shopping, his favorite activity, it's clear he believes Reed, who started 31 games for the 8-24 Wolverines last season, is a player who can help UConn stay on top of the college basketball world. The St. Louis native and four-star recruit out of Link Year Academy averaged 9 points and 7.2 rebounds per game as a sophomore last year while shooting 51.9% from the field. So who is Terrace Reed exactly, and what strengths does he bring to UConn? We asked Andrew Kahn, Michigan men's basketball beat writer for the MLLive.com, about his game and how he might fit into plans for the two-time defending champs. By the way, this story is written by Kels Dayton. The interview has been edited for length and clarity, and I will read as much of it as I can. First, the current says, how would you describe Reed's time at Michigan? The coach says, well, to take you back, freshman year he played 12, 13 minutes a game because they had Hunter Dickinson starting as center. He cleaned up around the basket, was a good rebounder, and played really good defense. He was not a starter, but he was a closer. Head coach Juan Howard always said he'd come in and he'd be a rim protector. He'd switch on to guards and move his feet pretty well. It was promising. And I'm going to just move on quickly to these questions. What difference did you see in his game this year as opposed to his freshman year? contest. His field goal percentage was about the same, 51.9%. His free throw percentage went away up, though, still not good, 58.6% last season, up from an abysmal 40% his freshman year. Another question from the current, could you see Terrace taking over as UConn's starting center? And Khan, I want to be clear who Khan is. He is Michigan men's basketball beat writer, not the coach, as I mentioned before. He's a beat writer for this interview. And I'll repeat that question. Could you see Terrace taking over as UConn's starting center? And Khan says, yeah, I mean, he's not clinging. Klingon was amazing defensively. He was all these things I'm talking about, Reed, but just at a higher level. Just great hands and unbelievable rim protector and bigger. Reed's not quite 7 feet, but guys typically are transferring with the thought of starting, right? Could he play alongside another big Samson Johnson? He did that with Dickinson, but Dickinson was a shooter. You don't typically want two non-shooters out there. That's not Reed's game. Another question from the current, were you surprised that he ended up transferring to UConn? Khan says, yeah, certainly, probably some surprise, yeah. Like, okay, he's going to be the two-time defending national champs, going to them, rather. Good for him, but he showed enough flashes. This team went 8-24 last year, so everyone looked worse than they could be. They were bad as a team, so the individual parts didn't look as good. But you take a step back, and it wouldn't be hard to think about some of those guys as a better team thriving. Reed probably played too many minutes, and they probably tried to run too much offense through him, so it hurt him, and it hurt the team. But at UConn, all the pieces are going to be better, you'd think, so it should work out better for him. Another question by the current, as far as his offensive game, you said he's not a shooter. Does he have a mid-range game, or is he just a post player? Khan says, yeah, it's back to the basket. Right near the basket, he would catch. At a championship level. Khan says it's hard to see that team getting much better, and losing a guy like Klingon, that's not a good thing. Can he step in and give you exactly that production? That's a lot to ask. But yeah, he's a talented player who certainly does some of those things that Klingon gave you, so there's promise there. But yes, he can absolutely be a starter on a very good team. He definitely can. The other pieces matter there too. Of course, he can't be the best player on a national championship team, I don't think, not right now, but there's still definitely room for growth. The school of thought is that bigs sometimes take a little bit longer to develop than guards, so I think the hope is that he's getting better at a higher rate than some other players. Well, that's it for the sports for today. Thank you for listening. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
I'm Laura Nato. Welcome to this week's edition of Information Plus. Our first article, titled Local Names Win Prestigious Arts Award, comes from the Sunday CT section of the Hartford Current, written by Christopher Arnault. Artists and scholars from Connecticut among those chosen for Guggenheim Fellowships. Of the 188 people chosen to be Guggenheim Fellows in 2024, quite a few have ties to Connecticut. The awards have been given annually since 1925 and are considered among the most prestigious honors given to leading figures in arts, sciences, and humanities. Most of the Connecticut-related names on this year's list are affiliated with Yale University. Yale is second only to Harvard in the number of faculty members that have received Guggenheim fellowships over the years. The Yale-based 2024 fellows are Elizabeth Hinton, a professor of history, African American studies, and law at both Yale University and Yale Law School. Douglas Rogers, professor and chair of Yale Department of Anthropology. Marta Figlerowitz, associate professor of comparative literature and of English. Ned Blackhawk, professor of history and American studies. Tavia Nyongs, chair and professor of theater and performance studies, as well as professor of American studies and professor of African American studies. Travis Zade, professor of religious studies and the program in medieval studies, who is also on the Council of Middle East Studies and the director of the Yale program of Iranian studies, and Ben Hagare, a lecturer at the Yale School of Art. Other Connecticut Guggenheim fellows include playwright Martina Majok, a 2012 graduate of the Yale School of Drama, now the David Geffen School of Drama at Yale. Majok's play Sanctuary City is currently playing at Theater Works Hartford on Pearl Street through April 25th. Legendary jazz guitarist and composer Rodney Jones, a New Haven native and longtime Connecticut resident. Julia Wolf, who co-founded the eminent neoclassical music ensemble Bang on a Can with two Yale School of Music graduates, and who has been in Connecticut many times as a member of the group, including performances at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. Multifaceted dancer and scholar Hari Krishnan, a Wesleyan University professor who has taught in the dance department as well as in Global South Asian Studies and Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies programs. Krishnan is currently developing a new dance piece that will premiere at Wesleyan in December. Among the many other 2024 Guggenheim awardees are Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, political journalist Jonathan Alter, photographer Sarah Bennett, known for her studies of incarcerated women, social activist Jessica Blinkhorn, indigenous artist Nicholas Gallinan, and octogenarian multidisciplinary Boston artist Lorraine O'Grady. The prestigious awards include monetary stipends. The exact amounts given to the awardees these years have not been disclosed, but are said to average between $40,000 and $50,000. Over the 99 years it has existed, the Guggenheim Foundation has bestowed over $400 million on thousands of artists, scholars, historians, writers, and scientists. Major 20th century figures who receive Guggenheim fellowships include environmentalist Rachel Carson, black literary icon James Baldwin, modern dance innovator Martha Graham, poet E.E. Cummings, and chemist activist Linus Pauling. Next up, helping wildlife back on their feet. Woman went from concerned citizen to certified rehabilitator by Maureen Murphy, still on the Sunday CT pages. Jessica Buchholz puts her heart into saving wildlife. Her work as a state-certified wildlife rehabilitator is done on a volunteer basis and through Wild Hearts Animal Rehabilitation in Middletown. It all started years ago when she came upon an injured baby fox, she said. He appeared to have a broken leg, likely from being hit by a car. My heart broke for this poor baby as cars continued to pass by around him. Using a blanket from my car, I gently scooped him up and got him to safety, she said. While she now has been a state-certified wildlife rehabilitator for 6 years, at the time she found the fox, she had been a pet sitter, whose business, Paw Prints, is located in Middletown. Her motivation to protect and rehabilitate wildlife is a journey from concerned citizen to certified wildlife rehabilitator, she said. Wildlife rehabilitators go to great lengths, largely at their own expense, to save injured and compromised creatures, she said. In dealing with the baby fox, also known as a kit, she did lots of research on Google and identified a veterinarian who agreed to treat his injuries and then placed the young fox with a wildlife rehabilitator until he was strong enough for release. That was my first time learning about wildlife rehabilitation. I knew instantly that I wanted to become a licensed rehabilitator. In order to become certified, Buchholz said, she followed the State of Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection requirements. I began apprenticing with other licensed rehabbers, she said. Buchholz also completed a one-day course that the state offers annually, followed by an exam. A minimum of 40 hours of apprenticeship are required. I also found a veterinarian who was willing to sign on to assist me with wildlife treatment as needed, such as for medications like antibiotics and anti-inflammatories, as well as providing general guidance, she said. Connecting with a veterinarian is part of the required process. About a year after deciding to become a wildlife rehabilitator, I had my certification to rehab small mammals, she said. A variety of wildlife have been treated over the past 6 years. I have cared primarily for squirrels, opossums, bunnies, and mice, Buchholz said, noting her future plans include expanding her efforts. I am currently working towards becoming an RVS, rabies vector species, certified rehabber, so that I can care for raccoons, foxes, and skunks, she said. Because these species can potentially carry the rabies virus, special immunizations and specific caging is required to care for them. For now, many animals show up on our doorstep through the DEEP website or a Facebook group where wildlife rehabilitation caregivers can communicate with one another about wildlife in need. Sometimes I'll find critters posted by other rehabbers that I am able to take in, Buchholz said. The spring, summer are by far the busiest times to get calls during baby season. Orphaned babies are the most common calls I get, followed by animals that were dog or cat caught. About her favorite rehabilitation success story, Buchholz notes, Opie. Opie was a baby opossum found crawling across the road. A good Samaritan got him to safety, and I took him in for rehab a few hours later. He didn't appear to have feeling or use of his back legs. Then we slowly started doing some water therapy, and he would kick his little legs as a reaction to being in water. As time went on and we continued therapy, his back legs became more and more functional until he was getting around quite well. Unfortunately, Buchholz said, Opie remained slow and unsteady at times, and it was eventually determined that despite his progress, he would not be able to survive on his own in the wild. Around the same time, she said she received word that Roaring Brook Nature Center in Canton was looking for an educational ambassador opossum and could provide a loving home for Opie. I went for a meet and greet, and he won them over instantly. Despite not being releasable, I still consider him one of my greatest success stories. He lived in the lap of luxury while teaching visitors about the docile nature of the often misunderstood opossum, Buchholz said. Jay Kaplan, director of Roaring Brook Nature Center, said Opie's mother had apparently been hit by a car and that he was injured as a result. Opie resided by the Roaring Brook Nature Center for a couple of years and was part of their nature education program, Kaplan said. Kaplan noted the current concern in state wildlife rehabilitation circles about House Bill 5217, a proposal to ban sale of second-generation anticoagulant rodenticides. Kaplan said rodenticides use a non-discriminatory. It affects everything. It doesn't matter who is using them. Wildlife, cats, dogs are all at risk. Buchholz said that in her 6 years of experience in the rehabilitation field, a lot of wildlife displacement injury is the result of human activity. Recognizing the need for change due to the increased number of sick birds that have consumed rodents or other mammals that are considered nuisance wildlife, she said House Bill 5217 would help prevent needless deaths. Second-generation anticoagulant rodenticides, or ESGARs, used to kill nuisance wildlife, then passes to other animals through the food chain, Buchholz said. ESGARs have been found to be the cause of death in many raptors, including federally protected bald eagles. Myself and other wildlife rehabilitators are hopeful the Connecticut lawmakers will vote in favor of banning ESGARs and prevent the needless suffering and death of our most majestic creatures, Buchholz said. Professional exterminators argue that the poisons are necessary to control infestations of rodents. House Bill 5217 was voted out of the Environment Committee, then referred to by the House to the Appropriations Committee, records show. Meanwhile, Buchholz continues her work along with other wildlife rehabilitation experts, specializing in healing small birds, hawks and owls, ducks and geese, certain small mammals, deer, bear, bobcats and coyotes, reptiles and amphibians, and more. Anyone who encounters wildlife in need of help can contact Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Dispatch at 860-424-3333 or search the website for certified wildlife rehabilitation professionals at https://dep/wildlife/rehabilitator/dealing-with-distressed-wildlife. Information on how to become a licensed wildlife rehabilitator is also available there. Continuing in the Sunday CT section, at Little Dipper Farm, a win for conservation. This is by Don Stakem. More than half of land sold to environmental nonprofit. 3 years after buying the former Golden Lamb Buttery and 588 acres of farmland and woods in Connecticut's rural Quiet Corner, Lori and Venus Corriveau have sold more than half the land to a national environmental nonprofit to ensure it remains undeveloped in the future. The Corriveau's Little Dipper Farm in Brooklyn and its ambitious agritourism activities will remain, and their new farm glamping operation, Glamour Camping with an agricultural flair, will soon get underway. The Corriveaus are holding on to 271 acres along the popular Chef's Table dining operation that took the place of the Golden Lamb Buttery, an iconic restaurant in northeastern Connecticut for decades. But they've sold 317 acres of the property to the Conservation Fund, and ultimately that land will end up in the hands of the Wyndham Land Trust, Lori Corriveau said. When we first bought it, we had so many plans. We were out in those woods trying to get the trails cleaned up and make it a good place for biking, she said Thursday. Very quickly, we realized it was too much for us, and this land wasn't where the core of our property was. The sale ensures the land won't eventually wind up with real estate investors and developers looking to build shops, subdivisions, or condos. It's a good thing for the town. That land is a prime piece of property, and we don't need to have it developed, Brooklyn First Selectman Austin Tanner said Thursday afternoon. This is very good. In a statement, Wyndham Land Trust board member Janet Booth praised the Corriveaus for finding a way to protect the land. They breathed life into the conservation efforts of this iconic 317 acres of forest and wetland habitat in Brooklyn and Pomfret, Booth said. Importantly, these 317 acres connect to a much larger area of conserved land. Connecting large blocks of habitat is paramount to the survival of other species that share our world and is a keystone to preserving the quality of life for all. The Conservation Fund is spending $550,000 for the 317 acres, and Corriveau emphasized that it will maintain public access for hiking its six-mile loop trails. The deal began with a sadder development in 2019, when Brooklyn lost a cherished and surprisingly well-known business after 55 years. Located along Wolf Den Road in a town of fewer than 9,000 people, the Golden Lamb Buttery nevertheless built a wide-ranging base of loyalists impressed by its early adaptation of upscale farm-to-table dining. In 2004, photos described the Golden Lamb's popularity, writing Connecticut's most unusual dining experience has achieved almost legendary status. The family that opened the restaurant and the surrounding Hillendale farm retired in 2017, though, and the next year the entire 588-acre property went on the market for $3.9 million. There were no takers, and some residents of Brooklyn and neighboring Pomfret grew concerned that developers would inevitably descend on it. Instead, the Corriveaus bought it during the pandemic. Lori Corriveau said she and her wife paid $2.5 million and embarked on an extensive agritourism campaign. The farm now offers tours and activities ranging from afternoon teas, farm dinners, salsa festivals, and seasonal festivals to hikes, cooking classes, scavenging for wild blueberries, and the bourbon in the barn whiskey tasting. Last year, the Corriveaus won local zoning permission to offer farm glamping on the property, providing overnight stays for guests who want to reconnect with nature and perhaps try their hands at farm activities. "We're doing things that immerse people in the farm environment and in nature," Corriveau said. "My wife and I come from backgrounds of appreciating nature and conservation, and she's been hiking this property for many years. And we know the Wyndham Land Trust is revered in Northeast Connecticut," she said. "We knew the property would be better in the hands of this conservation organization." The Conservation Fund will hold ownership of the land with a plan to eventually transfer it to the Wyndham Land Trust. The Little Dipper Farm is a local gem, and I applaud the Corriveaus for demonstrating how conservation and economic development can go hand in hand, Kyle Schenk, Northeast Regional Director for the Conservation Fund, said in a statement. Behind the Wine, pairing tantalizing food with French wine. This is by Johnny Noakes. As your intrepid guide on this vinous adventure, I'm here to dive headfirst into the world of wine, from the vineyards of Tuscany to the hot, arid vineyards of Paso Robles and everywhere in between, all accompanied by the tantalizing creations of top chefs and occasionally yours truly. We're not here for the stuffy and the mundane. No, we are on a mission to shed light on the hidden treasures of the wine world, casting aside the pretense and mediocrity that often plague it. But fear not, my fellow gastronomes, for amidst the sips and swirls, there will be laughter, there will be revelry, and just maybe a nugget or two of culinary enlightenment. So grab your forks and knife, a pristine wine glass, and some bail money. The bus is about to depart. The Rhone Valley, more specifically the Northern Rhone, or as the French call it, Septentrional, Latin for of the north. Here, expensive red wine, Syrah, is king, and the steep terraced terrain plays folly to the unprepared or overserved. What Chef Rep and I want to show you is a taste of the region both in your glass and on your plate, a mere peek inside AOC's, Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, Certification of Wines, of Côte Rôtie and Cornas, that will spur you on to learn more, or maybe not. Either way, you will drink and eat like royalty. At the end of the German occupation of France, a group of American and French soldiers were moving north from the Mediterranean, drawing over closer to the Rhone Valley. Under the suggestion of the French command, they decided to split apart from the American forces to search and explore for enemy remnants and artillery. Oddly enough, the French took the east side of the Rhone River, and the Americans took the western side of the Rhone. Seems like a simple random decision at first, but as you dig deeper, you'll find some of the greatest vineyards in France just happened to be on the east side. The French would never have left the Americans to trample through the best vineyards of the Rhone Valley, all the while recklessly consuming some of the most expensive wines, like so much inexpensive beer. The French were simply protecting their national treasure that had almost been stolen away by Germany. The variety and terroir being protected was Syrah and the Northern Rhone, respectively. Syrah, with its earthy tones of leather, blackberry, and peppery spice, is dark ruby to purple in color, can be tannic, and at times unruly in its youth on the palate. Vines range from upward of 40 years old, having wild depth and concentration, which is then only capable of being tamed by Father Time into a harmonious, lengthy wine that can stand up to any form of wild game or beef you can throw on a plate. Then Ambassador to France Thomas Jefferson once remarked on the wines of Côte Rôtie, "There is a quality which keeps well, bears transportation, and that cannot be drunk under 4 years." He couldn't have been more spot on in his observation. This wine needs time before approaching. As we drive into Côte Rôtie, French translation Roasted Hillside, you will notice the dangerously steep and terraced western slopes of the valley of Ampuis, where the grapes must be carefully hand-picked by sure-footed workers walking over a soil of granite and schist for the most part. No wine drinking until after the day is done, as some of the inclines can approach 60 degrees. Harvesters dying from falls is not all that uncommon. No wonder these wines are so expensive. The wines from this region come from Côte Brunet and Côte Blonde. Wines will usually be a blend of these areas as to create a wine with the power of Brunet and the elegance of the Blondes. Another advantage gifted only to Hermitage and the Northern Rhone by French law is the ability to blend a white varietal into the red. This is always Viognier and can be as much as 20%, but usually falls under 10%. Viognier offers weight and a livelier nose to Syrah. This wine AOC most likely predates the Romans, but until Marcel Gugal in the 1980s brought this region and its magical wines to the forefront of the general wine world, it remained a closely guarded secret of wine snobs the world over. The wine is expensive, with extreme weather terrain and limited acreage assuring that costs stay high. Now on to one of my favorite wine regions in the world that no one really talks about except wine geeks like me. That AOC is Cornay, or the Corroz, Hermitage, and Côte Rôti. With chalk, sand, and stone soil throughout the region, its steeply terraced southeast-facing geographical location shields it from the cold and unpredictable Mistral winds, and that badder Côte Rôti. Unlike Côte Rôti, Hermitage Cornay is not allowed to blend the white varietal Viognier, so all you get is Syrah. What Cornas offers, however, is more of a masculine, untamed, smack-you-in-the-teeth Syrah, with loads of leather and spice wrapped up in a dense purple package in your glass. Mind you that this wine is not for everyone, as it is big and a bit unruly. Cornas is by comparison to Côte Rôti, is a bargain and should be consumed 8 to 10 years from the bottle vintage. Harder to find, yes, but worth the search. Oh yes, pair this wine with some sort of red meat, which brings us to the next bit of business. This week's recipe is for roasted rack of venison. First step, open the bottle of the Northern Rhone wine and decant for at least an hour. Serves 4 3-pound rack of venison, a quarter cup of olive oil, 4 cloves of garlic chopped, 1/4 cup of fresh chopped rosemary, 4 tablespoons of Dijon mustard are enough to cover the rack, 5 slices of thick cut bacon, 1.5 cups of red wine, Syrah, 4 cups of beef or veal stock, 1 cup each, celery, carrots, onion. Method 1. Marinate the venison with the canola oil, chopped garlic, and rosemary 4 hours or overnight before cooking. 2. Preheat the oven to 425 degrees. 3. Heat a large sauté pan to screaming hot. Season the venison liberally with kosher salt and pepper. 4. Add 1 tablespoon of canola oil to the pan and sear the venison rack to create a nice brown crust, about 2 minutes aside. 5. Remove the venison and smother the top with the Dijon mustard. Place the bacon lengthwise over the mustard. 6. Add the carrots, onion, and celery to the pan. Place the venison over them and pour in the red wine. 7. Roast the venison for 30 minutes at 425, then raise the temperature to 500 degrees and roast for 15 minutes more until medium rare. Remove from the oven and let rest for at least 10 minutes. Deglaze the pan with 1/4 cup of red wine and then add 2 cups of low-sodium beef broth to the pan, reduce by half on high heat and strain. For a thicker sauce, whisk in 1 to 2 tablespoons of superfine flour, serve with mashed potatoes or polenta, and roasted Brussels sprouts. Done. Johnny Noakes is sommelier and manager at Maximum Beverage. This is his Behind the Wine column. The recipe is by Chef David Rep. Noakes notes the 3 Maximum Beverage locations are stocked with Northern Rhone wine and have been serving Greater Hartford for over 20 years. At the West Hartford store that he manages, you might just catch him holding court, ready to field questions, comments, and fill tasting glasses. Rep is part owner, chef of Kake Restaurant in Punta Gorda, and Mila's on the Manatee in Palmetto, both in Florida. And for you Francophiles out there, forgive me for butchering all the French in that last story. I'm turning now to the insight section of the Sunday Hartford Current. And starting with the story called Sky's the Limit, Lawmakers Need to Embrace Brainerd for Its Opportunities. This is by Robert Hamm. A recent study has concluded Hartford-Brainerd Airport's best use is as an airport. A 2016 study reached the same conclusion. These taxpayer-paid studies show the need to craft a forward-looking strategic plan for Brainerd Airport as a community aviation resource. Public hearings about Brainerd had little serious discussion about existing businesses, the jobs and tax revenues they generate, and opportunities for growth. Also absent has been an exploration of the many educational opportunities Brainerd provides. Training and jobs related to pilots as well as mechanics and avionics technicians on site are part of the aviation jobs sector that is part of Connecticut's industrial core. Civil Air Patrol, CAP, maintains a volunteer squadron which conducts pilot training and proficiency. CAP also teaches young members ground support techniques such as search and rescue. Life skills provided by CAP are in demand for area high school students. A strategic plan would not only support the existing businesses, which employ more than 250 people, it would capitalize on the limitless potential of the facility. Without such a plan, Brainerd will continue to languish as potential investors stand back while lawmakers endlessly debate its future. The 2023 study concluded that non-aviation redevelopment would require costly ground remediation that could take decades, providing zero training, jobs, or tax revenues while being done. Flood dikes, which prevent seasonal flooding and proximity to an active sewage treatment plant, further limit the development options. Governor Ned Lamont correctly boasts that aviation is a pillar of Connecticut's economy. Current jobs and training at Brainerd are part of the state's aviation ecosystem that will flourish if the politicians set their sights on developing a blueprint for investment and growth for the industry already there. Lawmakers need to embrace Brainerd for its opportunities to foster imagination and excitement among our youth, create additional high-paying jobs, generate taxes, and serve as a pipeline to countless other aviation businesses and companies based in Connecticut and the region. Massive shakeup on Connecticut's Cannabis Council. This is Kevin Rennie's column. The state's cannabis programs Social Equity Council began the year by purchasing 3,000 each of yummy round lip balm with melon flavor, black tote bags, lime with black trim alligator clips, and green pen sprayer hand sanitizer, alarming Andrea Comer. Upon learning of those and other SEC expenditures, Comer announced on April 4th she was resigning as chair of the state agency's finance committee. Comer's concerns reached Governor Ned Lamont. He appointed her as the new chair of the Social Equity Council with millions of dollars to spend and not a lot of rules on how to spend it. Comer was there at the beginning of the cannabis program as deputy commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection in charge of launching it. She also served as the first chair of the SEC. The Hartford resident understands the agency's obligations to assist people from communities disproportionately impacted by the prohibition of marijuana to win licenses. Comer left those two positions in 2023 to join State Treasurer Eric Russell as his chief of staff. Russell appointed Comer as his designated member of the SEC. She returned ready to resume her work, this time as the chair of the SEC's Finance Committee. There have been some tensions in the SEC. It does not always run smoothly. It includes no phone number on its website. A veteran of state government like Comer hears from people who know things and discreetly share them. In an April 4th email to Paul O. Robertson, the then chair of the SEC and deputy commissioner of the Department of Economic and Community Development, Comer wrote of her continuing concerns regarding the lack of communications around the unexpended funds and proposed expenditures by the SEC. But I was recently notified that there have already been expenditures that warrant concern. That dismaying information came to Comer from another state agency. The SEC spent $35,000 on an in-state conference for a sponsorship as well as hotel stays and incidentals for SEC staff. The conference was the February 25th-26th third annual Cannabis Expo at the Mohegan Sun. It was three CT cannabis events rolled into one, Connecticut Cannabis Business Convention, Consumer Expo, and the X Cup. The SEC purchased a $2,800 sponsorship for the event, entitling it to a booth. Hotel rooms for four staff members for two nights cost $3,095. Comer told Robertson in her message that she had previously flagged my concerns regarding the lack of communication around unexpended funds and proposed expenditures by the SEC. She was quitting as chair of the Finance Committee because, as the representative for the state treasurer, which is the fiduciary for the state, I cannot in good conscience serve as chair of the SEC's Finance Committee when such expenditures are taking place absent that committee's awareness. So nix the 3,000 11-inch lime green balloons. Robertson replied to Comer a day later, agreeing there desperately needs to be a process in place to oversee expenses such as this. Robertson had approved $30,850 for those incidentals listed above, plus banners, two hard cases with wheels, and a booth in a box. He asked her to remain in her position until we institute this critical process of oversight and approval, then step down afterwards. Comer is staying, but now as chair will lead the way forward. It's expensive to apply for a cannabis license to grow or sell that does not fall under the social equity guidelines. Applicants pay millions of dollars to the state, with no guarantee they will be issued a license. Those millions should be spent, as Comer described it to Robertson, on prioritizing social equity and investing in communities most harmed by the war on drugs. Last year, the SEC distributed six $1 million grants to organizations around the state for reentry reintegration programs that support formerly incarcerated individuals and their families, and for youth education, recreation, and arts programs that help promote physical and mental health wellness and empower young people in the future workforce. According to SEC Communications and Legislative Program Manager Christina Diamond, this year the agency will distribute $30 million to successful applicants seeking a piece of a new and significant fund. That amount of money will attract a lot of interest from organizations with varying records of success. Sorting, reviewing, and approving proposals will require rules that are consistently applied. Comer understands a state agency that spends $3,780 on melon-flavored lip balm with an SEC logo may not be ready to award $30 million in grants to effective programs that can withstand the scrutiny of others in state government and losing applicants. Returning Comer to the leadership of an agency with a lot of money to spread around is a prudent act by Lamont. Other safeguards will need to follow before $30 million starts flying out the door in those $3,000 tote bags with the SEC logo. Continuing in the insight section of the Hartford Current from Sunday, April 14th, reining in online Wild West of sports betting where public loses. This is by Richard Blumenthal. As March Madness peaked last week with the NCAA championships, so did the mania of sports betting, a sign of spreading gambling addiction spawned by companies that exploit vulnerable bettors. By the time the UConn men's basketball team routed Purdue in the national championship Monday night, more than $2.7 billion was bet by roughly 70 million Americans, most of them losing. The South Carolina-Iowa Women's Basketball Championship was the most bet on women's college basketball game in history, and the biggest winners were sports betting companies like DraftKings, FanDuel, and BetMGM that have made online gambling a hugely lucrative cash cow. Through their pitches and promotions, credits, and bonuses, these companies enlist people in their first bets and then entice them to do more. Sports betting behemoths exploit problem gamblers, and their predatory practices have contributed to unprecedented levels of gambling addiction. The result is a public health crisis, burgeoning addiction and betting losses spawning hideous costs in financial debt and bankruptcy, job loss, theft and fraud, family breakdown, drug and alcohol abuse, and much more. Many of those costs are ultimately borne by our whole society. Solutions need to recognize key changes in sports betting as a business supporting its spread. The rapidly growing trend of gambling legalization by states, indeed participation by states in the business itself, has made gambling more acceptable and accessible. When sports betting was prohibited, the bookie on the street corner or the telephone line was often hiding in plain sight. He made the odds, collected from losers, paid winners, and took a cut. Needless to say, there wasn't much sophisticated marketing and promotion, and exploitation of problem gamblers was pretty rudimentary. Online gambling technology combined with legalization has fundamentally changed gambling and sports betting in America. New online technology enables sports betting companies to collect reams of data about gamblers, how and what they're betting, in real time. Algorithms empower them to pitch credits, bonuses, and other enticements, even as they're online making bets. Technology could enable bettors to better protect themselves by allowing them to block themselves from platforms through self-exclusion features. But the online betting companies, perhaps unsurprisingly but very unfortunately, have made self-exclusion difficult to accept or use. Sometimes they actually seem to talk problem gamblers out of it, as the Wall Street Journal recently reported. The net result? An online Wild West in sports betting where the big guys win and individual people and the public interest loses. As important as technology and legalization are in fostering this toxic online environment is lack of treatment. Gambling addiction must be recognized as a disease like addiction to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. It isn't enough just to stop promotions. Problem gamblers need help. Astonishingly, while the federal government rightly provides hundreds of millions of dollars for treatment programs addressing drugs, alcohol, and tobacco, not a penny is spent on gambling addiction. That's totally incomprehensible and unacceptable. I've proposed a first step toward federal treatment funding, the GRIT Act, which would use one half of the revenue from the federal excise tax that is already collected on wagers to support gambling addiction treatment. The excise tax is minuscule, only 0.25%. Right now, all the money goes into the U.S. Treasury's general fund. This measure would impose no new tax, nor would it raise any existing tax. It would simply redirect a modest sum of present revenue to address health damage resulting from industry-generated revenue. This proposal should be bipartisan. Fans in Connecticut and across the country thrill to our favorite sports teams, pro or college. We gleefully surrender to March Madness. Most bet what they can afford, in moderation, but some number are afflicted with a health issue that can devastate their lives, livelihoods, families, friendships, and more. More steps are needed to regulate and rein in current sports betting practices with guardrails and safeguards. Sports betting and gambling needn't be an online Wild West. In fact, they can't be, for all our sake. And help give our kids a fighting chance. Opportunities in public education too often determined by zip code. This is by Philip Regeer. Public school education is the foundation of a thriving, equitable society and the mechanism to empower young people and communities to rise above systemic inequality. A high-functioning public school system, whether rural or urban, also contributes to a robust workforce that keeps us at the forefront of global competition and benefits citizens throughout the state. Yet in the state of Connecticut and throughout the United States, opportunities in public education are too often determined by zip code and a profound inequality in public school funding. There is a fundamental inequity in the design of public education funding, restricted to borders of municipalities, which inherently favors affluent communities where higher median incomes and higher property values generate substantial revenue for schools. Unfortunately, Connecticut is no exception to this rule and is a clear example of how glaring income inequality can be even with towns that share a border. The consequences of funding disparities are multifaceted and will have long-lasting impacts for generations to come. Underfunded districts like Hartford Public Schools face a myriad of challenges, including increased concentration of student need, spiraling special education costs, including for Hartford residents who don't even attend Hartford Public Schools, and flat revenue that doesn't keep up with inflation, let alone ensure HPS students and teachers receive the same level of resources as their peers in the state. The repercussion of this underinvestment will be felt not only within the city of Hartford, but throughout the region and state as we compete for our highly skilled jobs in a highly competitive global labor market. Addressing these glaring inequities requires a comprehensive and dedicated approach. Firstly, state governments must step in to mitigate the disparities caused by local funding. This could involve implementing funding formulas that allocate more resources to schools in need and ensuring that special education, which is funded through the excess cost grant, is fully funded. I commend the Senate Democrats and appreciate the support of Senator Doug McCrory and Representative Jeff Curry in their leadership roles on the Education Committee for proposing Senate Bill No. 5, which would fully fund the excess cost grant. I must emphasize to all of the legislators and the governor that this is an immediate crisis requiring immediate relief and would significantly impact the district's financial well-being. For example, if the excess cost grant was fully funded, Hartford Public Schools would receive $3.6 million in deserved reimbursements. If it is only 90% funded, the district would have an additional $2 million. In the face of our current budget deficit, this money would go a long way. Secondly, there must be a commitment from the city of Hartford and our mayor to make meaningful investments in funding the Hartford Public Schools. Attracting residents to live in the city of Hartford was a priority of the previous administration, and the current administration has emphasized home ownership. How is that possible if the residents in this city graduate from college at a rate of 17%? How will we compete with nearby cities like Boston and New York City for the jobs of the future? Stagnant funding and a reliance on state or federal funds are not a recipe for success. We must create new revenue streams at a local level that are earmarked for education, as well as the social-emotional well-being of Hartford youth. The investment will pay off many times over in the form of a higher tax base, lower crime rates, and rich cultural and community engagement. Thirdly, we need to re-examine the unintended consequences of the second-choice ecosystem that most significantly impacts Hartford and our residents. While the spirit of the CHEF agreement is to promote access to high-quality education, a mission we share, we cannot pursue that goal at the expense of our neighborhood schools and residents. Next year, the district is projected to pay $122 million in tuition expenses for Hartford residents to attend non-HPS schools elsewhere. That equates to almost 33% of the overall district budget and is growing at an accelerated rate. In no scenario is that sustainable, nor does it allow for HPS students to receive the same per-pupil investments as their suburban counterparts. After accounting for tuition and the spiraling cost of special education, Hartford has approximately $14,800 in per-pupil investments compared to an averaging of $18,000 for the rest of the state. This discrepancy will only grow in our immediate future. I encourage all residents in the city of Hartford and the greater Hartford area to consider and reflect upon this societal imperative. A capital city without a properly resourced, high-quality public school system will have repercussions throughout the state and only further perpetuate the systemic inequities progressives have fought against for generations. More magnet schools are not the panacea. Hartford Public Schools has the parents, teachers, staff, leadership, and most importantly, the thousands of talented students needed to make up one of the most successful urban school districts in the country. We can serve as an economic engine for the state and region and ensure that all our citizens have the opportunity to pursue success and contribute in a meaningful way to our society. That all starts with equitable funding and a meaningful investment from our city, state, and federal officials. We can invest in education now, or we can pay for it later. Philip Regeer is chairman of the Hartford Board of Education. And turning to the Arts and Living section, a musical mashup this week features Bad Bunny, a ska celebration, and Mandy Patinkin. This is by Christopher Arnault from the Hartford Current. Some great meldings of loud, smooth, and brash musical notes can be found on Connecticut stages this week. Ska, a musical fusion of rock and reggae, gets a wide-ranging weekend celebration at Space Ballroom and Sublime with Rome, with a ska edge as well as pop, rock, and party band leanings, plays at Foxwoods Premier Theater in the legacy of the legendary California band of the 2000s, Sublime. Beausoleil marries accordions and fiddles at the Kate, and Bad Bunny puts a new spin on rap rock at the XL Center. Other great combinations on Connecticut stages this weekend include husband and wife actors and social media stars Mandy Patinkin and Catherine Grody, and food star Action Bronson and his rock act Human Growth Hormone. There are also a couple of multi-generational events which show how neatly culture can evolve and accommodate, including the games-filled Garden of Literacy event at the Stowe Center, the Parent-Child-Teacher Panic 25th Anniversary Putnam County Spelling Bee at UConn's Connecticut Repertory Theater, and the family-friendly musical version of Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day at Playhouse on the Park. Here are some of the things to see this week in Connecticut. Well, these first two have already happened, but I'll read them anyway in case you want to go to their websites and read up. A conversation with Mandy Patinkin and Catherine Grody at the Guard Arts Center, 325 State Street, New London. Married actors Mandy Patinkin and Catherine Grody have millions of followers on social media in videos shot and edited by their son. Together for around half a century, the couple chats, gripes, coos, and converses casually and entertainingly. Now they've brought their act to the stage, appearing April 14th at 3 p.m. at The Guard in New London, the same venue where Patinkin performed his concert act last year. Tickets were $53 to $152, and you can find out more at guardarts.org. That's GARDARTS.ORG. Hartford Jewish Playwriting Contest, Playhouse at the Park, 244 Park Road, West Hartford. The Jewish Plays Project, in collaboration with the Charter Oak Cultural Center, held its 8th annual Hartford Jewish Playwriting Contest on April 16th at 7 p.m. at Playhouse on the Park in West Hartford, with readings of Memoriam by Nora Flashen, Osher and the Infinite Curtain by Elise Wine, and Why Is This Night?, a typical queer 19th century shtetl murder mystery by Daniel Kittrosser. That was $10. You can find out more at charteroakcenter.org. Action Bronson presents Dr. Baklava and Human Growth Hormone at the Webster, 31 Webster Street, Hartford. TV and YouTube foodie star Action Bronson has an alter ego, Dr. Baklava, who's the latest manifestation of Bronson's passion for rap and punk. He and his backup band, Human Growth Hormone, howl on April 18th at 8 p.m. at the Webster. Tickets $47.50 to $55. Find out more at thewebsterct.com. 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee at UConn Harriet S. Jorgensen Theater, 2132 Hillside Road, Storrs. The Connecticut Repertory Theater's spring musical, running April 18th to 28th, is the crowd-pleasing 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee by composer William Finn and writer Rachel Scheinkin from a concept by Rebecca Feldman. It's about a small-town spelling bee event that its home county is exorbitantly proud of holding. It's also about the dreams and anxieties of its young contestants. Much of the comic turmoil comes courtesy of parents and other authority figures. The show marks a return to the Harriet S. Jorgensen Theater at the University of Connecticut for the Connecticut Repertory Theater Company, which staged last year's musical Rent at a different space. crt.ucon.edu. Sublime with Rome at Foxwoods Resort Casino, 350 Trolley Line Boulevard, Mashantucket. Anything Sublime has to end sometime. Sublime with Rome's show at Foxwoods Premier Theater is one of the band's last live gigs ever. Their very last performance will be at Red Rocks Amphitheater in Colorado on April 27th and will be live streamed for posterity. Rome Ramirez, who has fronted this high-powered variation of the legendary ska, pop, punk band Sublime since 2009, is moving on to other projects. like the duo Rome and Duddy he has with Dirty Heads' Dustin Bushnell that played Hartford last month. These final Sublime with Rome shows will not be mournful. This is a propulsive outfit that turns every show into a party. It's April 19th at 8 p.m. Tickets $49 to $133. Find out more at foxwoods.com. Beau Soleil avec Michael Doucette, Catherine Hepburn Cultural Arts Center, 300 Main Street, Old Saybrook. The Louisiana-rooted Cajun music ensemble, Beau Soleil, still featuring its funding fiddler, Michael Doucette, has been around for a half a century now and has released dozens of albums. Its live shows are bursts of warm, sunny, French-tinged, soulful southern jazz. The Cate in Old Saybrook is one of the best venues in the state for such a show. April 19th at 8 p.m., $49. And find out more at thecate.org. Hartford Ska Weekend at Space Ballroom, 295 Treadwell Street, Hamden. Connecticut had a thriving ska punk scene back in the 1990s, largely based on the Tune Inn Club in downtown New Haven. The bands from those days are older now, but many are still around happy to reunite. Younger bands have also taken up the ska style. The Space Ballroom, which has inherited some of the vibe of the old Tune Inn, is hosting a two-day ska weekend, April 19th and 20th. Friday night is headlined by Sonic Boom 6, the British ska band that has been around since 2002, with Long Island's high school football heroes and Connecticut's own Drop Party also on the bill. The Saturday lineup is the Agrolites from the West Coast, a reunion of one of the best local ska bands of the 90s, Spring-Heeled Jack USA, plus Nick and the Adversaries from Boston, and Millington, which is technically a brass emo band act from Albany, New York. The trombones will be blaring. Each show starts at 8 p.m. Tickets for April 19th are $25, $20 in advance, while April 20th is $30, $26 in advance. And go to spaceballroom.com for more information. Garden of Literacy, Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, 77 Forest Street, Hartford. The Stowe Center's annual Garden of Literacy event unites nature and books in and around the institution's gorgeous plants and lawn April 20th from noon to 7 p.m. There are outdoor activities from noon to 5 p.m., everything from a poetry and writing table to hula hoops and bubbles. Indoors, there are workshops for writing poetry or science fiction at 1 p.m., $35 per person, attendance limited to 12. Registration is required. A reading of Dr. Seuss The Lorax for children at 2:30 p.m., and an intergenerational family tour of the center with the theme Inheriting Freedom at 3 p.m. HarrietBeecherStoweCenter.org, and in case you can't spell that, HarrietBeecherStoweCenter.org. CENTER.org. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince in concert, The Bushnell, 166 Capitol Avenue, Hartford. The Hartford Symphony Orchestra has been performing live orchestral accompaniments to the Harry Potter films since 2017, doing them in order, starting with Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Despite the COVID hiatus a few years ago, they're up to film number 6 now, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. April 20th at 1 and 7 p.m. at the Bushnell's Mortenson Hall, the guest conductor is Ron Spiegelman, $39 to $120, hartfordsymphony.org for more information. Bad Bunny at the XL Center, 1 Civic Center Plaza, Hartford. Bad Bunny's tour is called Most Wanted, and that's right. The big XL Center concert is finally happening for the insanely popular singer, rapper, producer. When tickets went on sale in October, there was a lottery for the mere chance to purchase tickets. Since that announcement, Bad Bunny's only gotten more famous, including appearing as both the host and musical guest on Saturday Night Live. You can find some tickets on the XL Center site now at prices that suggest their scarcity. April 20th at 8 p.m., $437.15 to $1,424.20. Go to xlcenter.com for more information or maybe just a chance for those tickets. And Alexander and T's Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day at Playhouse on the Park, 244 Park Road, West Hartford. Playhouse on the Park does a couple of big children's theater productions a year. The spring attraction, running April 20th through May 5th, is the musical version of the classic kids' book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. The script and lyrics are by the book's author, Judith Viorst, and music by Shelley Markham. Saturdays and Sundays at 1 and 4 p.m., $10, and go to playhouseonpark.org for more information. And I'll finish up today by this with this story from the arts and entertainment section. Curb Your Enthusiasm ends by remaking Seinfeld finale. Larry David has never apologized for the much-maligned Seinfeld finale, and he's not about to start now. The acclaimed writer and actor used the recent end of his long-running HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm, to double down on the last episode of the NBC 1990s mega-hit, daring viewers to hate it all over again. The results were less than hilarious, but it was an appropriate, clever act of defiance. More than 75 million people watched that 1998 episode of Seinfeld, but you might not remember the details. A quick recap. Jerry and the only three people on Earth who can stand him are arrested for breaking an obscure Good Samaritan law in Massachusetts. They are imprisoned after characters from their past pop up to give jurors examples of their extreme indifference to other people. David, who co-created the series, came back after a two-year hiatus to help write the send-off. The entire 12th season of Curb, which had its debut season in 2000, has dropped hints that its finale would echo the end of David's previous show. In the season premiere, Larry gets arrested in Georgia for giving water to someone in a voting line, violating a state law. The trial, which took up much of the 55-minute episode, consisted of characters from the past getting one last chance to gripe, triggering clips of Larry's most cringeworthy moments. Stealing shoes from the Holocaust Museum, beating a black swan to death with a golf club, and hiring a prostitute so he could use the carpool lane. The trip down memory lane did give us one last chance to salute some beloved guest stars, from political whistleblower Alexander Vindman to Bruce Springsteen, but it felt like one of those high school reunions. The series finale seemed like a good idea on paper, but once you're there, you kind of regret making the trip. What did work was watching David treat his ordeal as if he were trying to rub a grass.